Halfway through the year, and Milwaukee's homicide rate is double what it was this time last year. We're asking why on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The crises around us are clear: protests over police brutality and systemic racial oppression, economic desperation caused by the pandemic, global health crisis. Do you live in Milwaukee? Do you notice the surge in violence? How is your neighborhood doing? We're at 800-642-1234. Paul Formolo is acting assistant police chief of the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department. He joined the department in 1996, became a detective in 2001. Most of his time as a detective was devoted to investigating homicides. Chief Formolo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is behind the spike in homicides this year?
Well, several factors, compounding factors. And some of the stuff we did notice back in the late fall of 2019, but what we're seeing is family violence, an increase in family violence and intimate partner violence, along with people in mental health crisis, substance abuse, and a lot of our homicides are taking place on licensed premises, specifically like gas station parking lots.
Gas station parking lots. So these are not inside the homes, but you say that violence in the home is also increasing. What do you see there?
Well, we just, again, we saw this problem back in 2019. And in response to the family violence inside the home, Chief Morales, he facilitated a community summit back in February of 2020, where we met with our community leaders and our other stakeholders and law enforcement partners to try to come up with strategies to provide intervention and services to reduce the violence. And, you know, right when we're starting to get our strategy in place and start implementing mitigations, you know, we get hit with the COVID-19. And that compounds the issue, because with COVID-19, with the stay-at-home orders, and the social distancing, these services that are normally provided to people are limited.
What mitigations were you trying to put in place there as you look back at the fall of 19 and going forward before the pandemic struck? What were you trying to change?
Well, what we want to try to change is that there's services, there's outreach for people. We want to work with the Office of Violence and Prevention to put, people in the community that can provide interventions and mitigate and that type of stuff, you know. And we were just never really able to get that going where we wanted it to be because of, you know, the pandemic.
Let's look at the mass shootings for a moment. There have been two mass shootings in Milwaukee this year. February, a man killed five people at the Molson Coors campus before killing himself. And then April, a man allegedly killed five people in a house on the north side before being arrested. How much do these shootings affect the statistics?
Well, they're certainly anomalies, and it's going to cause a statistical spike. But with the Molson Coors shooting, you know, that reverts back to one of the factors that I named earlier with mental health. Our investigation revealed that person was, suffering mental health, in a mental health crisis.
You've been investigating homicides for a very long time, for decades. Do you feel that something is different now?
I do. What I feel right now is like you got a perfect storm. All right. I can't sit here and state causation, but there's certainly correlations. You know, you got the pandemic, and now you got the civil unrest. You put those things together, and you'll see that across the nation. We have a nationwide crime spike, violent crime spike, and that's definitely what's going on now. And with the civil unrest, that unfortunately distracts us from what we need to do as a police department, and that, as far as implementing our proactive policing strategies, interventions. So that's different than what years past.
We're talking with Paul Formolo, who is acting assistant police chief of the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department, examining the spike in homicides this year and what can be done behind it, you can join in with your feelings about what you see in your neighborhood. Do you live in Milwaukee? Have you noticed a spike in violence? Join in at 800-642-1234. Chief Formolo, how has the morale been inside your police department as you watch and assist with officers who are responding to the protesters?
I like to be an optimist. Definitely the morale is strained, certainly is. The incident that happened in Minneapolis with George Floyd is absolutely, unacceptable. And I haven't met a police officer that thought that that was okay, what happened. You know, that was absolutely wrong. But the outcry from the public with that, you know, is kind of casting a blanket over all policing. And I do think that affects the morale, you know, because of a very small number of officers who choose to do the wrong thing. We all pay the price for that, in the public eye. So that does take its toll on people. The civil unrest certainly took its toll on our police officers as well. They worked, you know, many of these officers worked 2 weeks straight without a day off. And, that just wears you down.
How many hours a day were their shifts?
During the heat of the civil unrest here in Milwaukee, which started on May 29th, most of these officers, especially our officers that were on the front lines, were working at least 16 hours a day consecutively.
What might that do to how officers can manage their jobs and their mental health and be able to show up and do their work?
Well, first of all, I thought there was just I witnessed an enormous amount of resilience by the Milwaukee police officers and restraint. Eventually, yes, that their decision making is going to erode with, you know, just being tired and exhausted. But you know, I think they did well. They did well. Our officers were just demonstrated in a high degree of professionalism throughout the whole civil unrest from May 29th for like the 10 days to we started seeing a decline in it.
Well, I want to look at non-fatal shootings here for a moment. Is violent crime in general on the rise in Milwaukee, or is the homicide figure an anomaly?
Violent crime is on the rise in Milwaukee, unfortunately. The non-fatal shootings are increasing as well. Our homicides are up 95% as of July 6th, and then our non-fatal shootings are up 56% as of July 6th. Those are statistics that we take seriously. And violent crime prevention is one of our main focuses with the Milwaukee Police Department.
Are non-fatal shootings an indicator of the rise in violence? Do you look at that to give as an indicator of homicide rate?
Yes, I do. Non-fatal shootings are a very good indicator.
We're looking at the spike in homicides this year in Milwaukee. Acting Assistant Police Chief Paul Formolo is in the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department. What do you want to know about homicides in the city? Do you remember living in Milwaukee in the early 90s? Did you experience violent crimes in your neighborhood? What is it like now? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Assistant Chief Paul Formolo here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you're just joining us, we're talking with the Milwaukee Police Department about the increase in homicides and how the ongoing pandemic may affect rising tension in the city. We're more than halfway through the year now, and the city's homicide rate is the highest it's been since the early 90s. And given the renewed scrutiny of police tactics due to George Floyd's death and protests, how do you want police and city officials to respond to the jump in violence in Milwaukee? Do you feel unsafe but reluctant to call the police? There's time to talk here, 800-642-1234. Paul Formolo is Acting Assistant Police Chief of the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department, and he stays with us. Chief, earlier you mentioned homicides happening at gas station parking lots. What seems to be driving this type of pattern?
The cruising and just the congregating of people. A lot of that congregation is a break off from the protesters. In the city of Milwaukee, what we have is we have the protesters, but along with the protesters, we have just caravans of cruisers, vehicles. A lot of them are, they're driving recklessly, endangering the lives of the citizens and motorists in our city. But, you know, after the protests are seem to end after nightfall, large groups of people will congregate in parking lots of gas stations, and that turns into basically an unchecked street party.
An unchecked street party. How do you do intervention when you do see situations like cruising and these caravans?
Well, we try to monitor it. We try to contain it. We obviously try to displace it as well. But a lot of times we just don't have the capacity, the number of officers to deal with those large crowds, and we're also outgunned in a lot of those. We have video of just the other night, in the Capitol Court Midtown area on Fond du Lac and Capitol, we had a quadruple shooting, and four people were shot. Thankfully, nobody died. But at that scene, we had over 200 casings recovered. So it's difficult for us to go in there and, with traditional police cars and officers and try to do any type of intervention.
Over 200 casings. How many guns were at that crime scene?
I can't give you that specific number right now. We will conduct a forensic analysis of all the casings recovered, and that will eventually give us the different types and number of firearms that were discharged during that event, but I just don't have that information for you right now.
Does the city have tools to, say, order businesses to change their security practices at all? What about the establishments themselves?
We do work with our licensed premises as much as possible. We go in there and we'll do an analysis of what they have in place for security, and we will give them recommendations. Our Department of Neighborhood Services also will ensure that these establishments are following city code and stuff like that. So we do work with our business owners as much as possible.
We're talking with Paul Formolo, who is Acting Assistant Police Chief of the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department. We're looking into the spike in homicides this year, factors contributing to violence in Milwaukee. Let's take a call now. Steve is joining us from Beloit this morning. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. My question is related to the department's use of force, and it kind of gets back to the civil unrest and some of the causes related to that. I'm wondering what the department is doing in changing antiquated and outdated use of force policies and training officers in new ways of de-escalating, sort of like crisis intervention teams. And is the department looking at that?
Yes, we are. As a police department, we're always looking at our policies and our tactics and training and techniques and applying use of force. It's constantly being revised and refined. As a matter of fact, we do have a use of force board, which basically reviews all of our uses of force, and that committee or board will look for if any of our equipment is outdated or obsolete, or if any of our techniques are obsolete. We're constantly refining our training and policies. It's an ongoing thing.
But when officers are working 16-hour shifts, is there time in the day to really have conversations about training and about developing and changing practices?
No. During events like that, no. You're relying on the training that you've already had. But after such an event, especially that magnitude, you want to do an after-action review. You want to critique yourself. There's no way I'm going to sit here and say that everything that we did during the civil unrest, especially the first 10 days, 7 to 10 days, that we did everything perfect. We realize that there's not a cop that doesn't go home at the end of their shift that probably doesn't lay in bed at night. So, you know, thinks, oh, I wish I would have did something different, you know. That's just the part of making yourself better as an individual officer and as an organization.
Chief Formolo, are people of color being disproportionately affected by this violence, this spike in violence?
I can tell you that the majority of our homicide victims are of a minority. Unfortunately, that's where a large portion of our violence takes place, is in our most challenged neighborhoods, which are heavily populated by minorities.
Last year, there were 97 homicides in Milwaukee, which had been quite a big drop as you look at the numbers. Do you have any theories for why crime had been declining?
I thought during 2018-2019, you're right. We were heading on the right track. We saw a significant reduction in homicides along with non-fatal shootings. I contributed that to what we call our shoot review process here in the city of Milwaukee, which is a weekly meeting where we discuss every firearm-related homicide and every non-fatal shooting with our community partners and our law enforcement partners. And the purpose of that meeting is to try to find the underlying cause for that violence, and to provide interventions to reduce retaliation. And I thought we were having a lot of success with that.
Have those conversations continued, or do you see that those meetings will continue?
We have been continuing, even through the COVID pandemic. We do it virtually with our partners. Having a meeting over Zoom or conference phone calls, that just doesn't replace meeting in person. And I think that's what we're losing. We need to reconnect with our partners within the criminal justice system as well as our community partners.
How has the pandemic changed the way the police are investigating and dealing with violent crime? Are there practices that are changing amid the pandemic?
Well, we show up to work every day. We still have to do our job. We try to conduct professional investigations and do everything as thorough as we would even outside, absent the pandemic. Our police officers have to wear personal protection equipment, PPEs. It's difficult for us to conduct in-person interviews with witnesses and even with people in custody, we have to take precautions, it's changed policing a little bit. And I think people are concerned with having these personal contacts for fear of spreading the virus.
Do officers have enough PPE, and do they know how to use it?
We were short. We had to ask the community for help. The community did step up, which was just amazing, especially some of the businesses within our community with the donations. But yes, we do have masks and hand sanitizer. We have eye protection for detectives and officers now. And if there is a shortage that is identified, we will quickly remedy it as quick as we can.
Before we have to go, I want to ask you about gang activity. What have you seen there in relation to the violence?
Gang activity is, that's something that we're focused on. We don't have the gang issues that other cities would have, like out on the West Coast or East Coast here in Milwaukee. But we do have issues between groups of people, and that's something that we try to identify during our shoot review process. And if we identify a group or a criminal organization, we will focus on trying to provide interventions or enforcement strategies to displace the violence.
Chief Formolo, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Paul Formolo is Acting Assistant Police Chief of the Criminal Investigation Bureau for the Milwaukee Police Department. Coming up, we talk with an infectious disease control physician about why coronavirus cases are spiking around the country and here in Wisconsin and what needs to happen next in the fight to bring the pandemic under control. What do you want to know about droplets, aerosols, and what masks can do? Your questions get answered, 800-642-1234. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is new scientific evidence that suggests the coronavirus can stay aloft in the form of these teeny tiny droplets in stagnant air. A group of hundreds of international experts signed an open letter this week to the WHO, the World Health Organization, asking for more guidance in explaining how the virus can transmit in the air. The WHO responded yesterday saying the evidence needs to be gathered and interpreted. What do you think needs to be done to slow the spread of the virus? What are your concerns about aerosols, droplets, and stagnant air? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and a faculty member at the UW School of Medicine Division of Infectious Disease. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
We're seeing a spike in cases here in Wisconsin. It's happening around the country. What is going on?
Well, I think what we're seeing is how a pandemic typically behaves. Because the entire population is vulnerable, it is expected that anytime human behavior changes, cases will rise in response to that.
How have we seen human behavior change in recent weeks?
Well, I think early on in the pandemic with the safer at home order, we noticed that physical mobility went way down, and with that, so did the cases. It remained suppressed until the time that people started moving around more and getting together in gatherings and so forth. And I think that's contributed to the increase that we're seeing.
In our state, despite the increases in cases, the number of reported deaths per week is slowing down. Why is that happening?
Well, I think there might be a couple of explanations. One is that the increase in cases are now occurring, or at least some of them are occurring in a younger demographic, and those are typically individuals who don't have some of the higher risk conditions that might lead to an increased risk of complications. And the other is that deaths is a lagging indicator and sometimes may take weeks before you would see that number go up.
So when you look at that younger demographic and the infection, what do you see in that population, you know, age 20 to 29 or so?
I think what we're seeing is that they typically will have milder symptoms. They will fortunately recover, or most will. Of course, it's not an entirely homogenous demographic. Even within the 20 to 30, there are several people who will get complications and will not have the expected good outcome. So I think we still have to be very careful, but that does seem to be the case, that they do relatively better.
And how do we gauge outcomes? When is someone rid of the virus or completely recovered?
There's a huge variation in recovery, and in part it depends upon the severity of the symptoms and the complications that may follow from the symptoms. In hospitalized patients, we're finding that there is a prolonged length of stay, and even after people recover, they still might take a long time before they would go fully back to where they felt before. In people who have mild symptoms, they may recover within a week to 2 weeks, although the physical presence of the virus may still take longer to completely disappear.
There's evidence that scientists are looking at a new strain of the virus. What are you seeing there?
They're trying to understand whether this explains some of the changes that we're seeing in the demographic of the population that is experiencing symptoms, in that the new strain appears to be easier to spread but doesn't cause as severe an illness. And it does seem to be fairly compelling evidence in the paper that was recently published describing it.
And so a strain that would be circulating in New York City, for example, would be different than what is circulating in Wisconsin communities. How does that work?
There are similarities, but there are also some differences. And in part, it depends upon where that strain was introduced into the U.S. from. And because there are multiple points of introduction, it's conceivable that some strains might have come from other parts of the world where the pandemic appeared sooner than it did in the U.S.
So as you see the spike here in Wisconsin and reverberating around the country, is it because we are reopening too soon? What is causing, is it a uniform cause around the country that you're seeing these numbers going way up?
I think each state is showing its own trajectory. And in part, yes, I think it is dependent upon, we have found it's very sensitive to human behavior. And so when we open up businesses and things, even though it's, of course, necessary to some extent, we have to be very careful in that we don't want to do it too fast, too soon, and then be prepared to roll it back if circumstances demand it.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's explaining the recent uptick in COVID-19 cases, what people should be doing to help stop the spread. You can join in with your questions. What do you think about the spike? How do you go about helping control the spread? How have you been changing your lifestyle as you watch the numbers? We're at 800-642-1234. We heard from Matt in Wausau, emailed us this morning, Dr. Safdar. Matt wants to see a statewide mandate for wearing masks. How much could that step help reduce cases?
You know, I think with a pandemic like this, where we don't have reliable therapeutics and there's no vaccine yet, we have to have a great deal of adherence to all the interventions that could potentially help. And masking is one of those suite of solutions, as is physical distancing. And so I think that, yes, we should all be masking anytime that the situation calls for it.
You've been looking at the number of people wearing masks, such as in and out of the grocery stores. What do you see there in those numbers?
We found that about half the people that were exiting grocery stores were not wearing masks. Women were more likely to wear masks than men, and older adults were more likely to be wearing masks than younger people.
Do you think that if communities start to make mask wearing mandatory, that those numbers would change? Or do you see that people are just really firm in whether they're going to wear a mask or not?
You know, I shouldn't think so. I would think that if there was an order, which there is now in Dane County, for mandatory masking, that behavior would change in response to that.
You know, earlier in our program, we were talking about shopping habits, and one listener tweeted about only shopping online because they refused to wear masks in stores. They called masks useless and nonsense. What is your response to that?
I think that, you know, we should confine ourselves, I think, to essential activities in person. And so when we do engage in those, and that might mean going to grocery stores, for instance, then we do have to wear a mask. Other types of shopping, I think, yes, it's probably preferable to not be in person. But if you do have to be in person, then wearing a mask is better than not wearing a mask.
Can you explain what a mask really does for us?
So a mask serves two purposes. It protects the wearer and it protects other individuals around them. And between two people, if one is wearing a mask, that's good. But if both are wearing a mask, that's even better.
And protecting them from droplets, protecting from sneezes, what is actually the protection against?
So it's protecting them from droplets. If the individual has symptoms, then yes, it will contain the large aerosolization of and the emission of secretions that happen when somebody has a respiratory illness.
You talked about aerosol there, and scientists are really wanting to get information out of the WHO about whether these aerosol droplets are transmitting the coronavirus. What are you wanting to learn about droplets?
I think we, you know, really want to have a great grip on our understanding of how COVID-19 and the virus that causes it is transmitted. And the reason why that's so important is because it drives what PPE is recommended and is used. I think that when the WHO evaluates its evidence, we're curious about whether it will change its recommendations or not. we traditionally in infection control do not think of SARS-CoV-2 as an classically airborne transmitted viruses, which we define as a virus that can travel large distances, sort of wafting along on air. By its definition, every respiratory illness is going to be transmitted via the air in some form or the other. But the droplet means that these are larger droplets that fall to the ground versus very small particles that keep floating and remain transmissible.
Are there any new discoveries into asymptomatic people and what the connection may be to aerosolization of the virus?
So asymptomatic transmission does appear to be important for COVID-19 transmission. While the exact numbers are not known, it is estimated that up to a quarter of infections may be transmitted that way. One of the things that complicates is that it's not clear whether it's entirely asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, meaning that they just hadn't developed symptoms at the time the test is done, or they have very mild symptoms that they may not even be aware of at the time, such as a loss of sense of smell and taste. But having said that, yes, asymptomatic transmission is important here.
How long might a person be pre-symptomatic?
Usually from, say somebody's asymptomatic, they get a test. Within that 10-week period following that is when they would typically develop symptoms if they were going to develop them.
When you look at the trend lines right now, are we considered to be in a second wave? Is it still too soon to tell? What do you look at when you're watching these numbers come out each day and the trends?
I think it's hard to say exactly because it's not behaving as you would expect a seasonal respiratory virus to behave. Normally, you'd expect, you know, there'd be a wave in the fall, then a lull in the summer, and a second wave in the fall. Here, we're seeing these high peaks at various points for, you know, differing between states. So I don't know that I can call it a second wave. It seems to be this smoldering in some areas and greatly increasing in others.
Well, yeah, and, you know, temperatures are very high here in the summer. I mean, we've had a string of 90-degree days and still a spike. So, you know, weather doesn't seem to be factoring into this, does it?
It doesn't appear to be, no.
So as you look at the hospital situation, are your hospital and clinics keeping up with the demand from testing and inpatient care?
You know, so far, hospital capacity, I think, has been doing well. But of course, the concern is that as the number of cases grow, will it happen after a few weeks that there will be individuals who get infected who will need hospital care and then will need to come in for that? So we want to be prepared for that if that happens.
Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's giving us an update on the recent surge in COVID-19 cases and what the medical community is doing and thinking about with the spread. Have you been tested? Do you think you were exposed at a gathering of people? What do you want to know about safety precautions as you head into work? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Safdar here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the surge of COVID-19 cases around the country and here in Wisconsin. Scientists are raising concerns with the WHO about crowded indoor spaces with poor ventilation that may help explain the spread in meatpacking plants, churches, restaurants. Are you wearing a mask when you go out? Do you frequent restaurants, bars, coffee shops? Are you sticking close to home? How do you manage risk at this point in the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Let's take a call now. Jenny is with us from Viroqua. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Now that dental offices have reopened, I'm wondering what your guest thoughts are on the safety of dental visits.
I think that dental offices, just like most other institutions, have taken a lot of steps to ensure that that their patients are safe when they come in. And that might include things like not having people wait in waiting rooms, making sure that they're masked when they go in. So if it's essential dental work that you need, I would think that now would be a safe time to do so.
Jenny, I just had a filling last week, week before, and I was just astounded by the safety measures. Not getting out of my car, texting when I'm there, and they come out or say when I can come in, holding the door open, I don't touch anything, escorting me right to my chair. I was astounded by the amount of PPE. And at the end of the visit, I was escorted out a back door, not even going in the door I came in. Dr. Safdar, what are some of these measures, and do you think that they are appropriate?
I think they're very appropriate for the type of transmission we know can happen with SARS-CoV-2. The whole idea is to promote physical distancing as much as possible. I mean, we know we have the 6 feet rule, and the reason that comes about is because that's the distance a large droplet would typically travel before it drops to the ground. So anything we can do to minimize people coming into contact with each other is a good idea to prevent transmission.
I also had to swish with hydrogen peroxide, and it was gross. It was awful. What is that doing?
It's an antiseptic for the mouth, as are many others. So not sure that by itself is doing much for this particular virus, but as an antiseptic following dental work, it's commonly used.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Let's go to Stephanie now in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a nurse that has so far avoided contracting the virus, and I'm scrupulous of wearing a mask everywhere I go. I know that the Czech Republic has managed to clear things because everyone wore the mask. I don't understand why we just can't mandate it and clear it up in a few weeks.
Stephanie, thank you for the call and for the work you're doing right now. Dr. Safdar, have you looked at other countries and how they have approached mask wearing?
I think that, you know, in the U.S., we historically have not had a culture of mask use, unlike many other countries, particularly in Asia, that have been wearing masks for much longer than we have. And any time that behavior is new, it will take time and dedicated discipline and energy to instill it. I do think that it is time for us to be very vigilant about wearing masks everywhere we go. And whatever measures will influence our behavior are important to take, which might require mandating it.
Stephanie, may I ask how you are doing as you work in a really stressful environment in nursing right now and trying to stay safe and stay free of the virus?
Well, I am full of optimism, and I know that we are very careful, that we're very good. I see what is going on to try and prevent the spread within the hospital. And it just, I actually talk to people when I'm outside and see them wearing a mask and say, thank you for respecting me. I respect you by wearing the mask. And I'm hopeful. I'm there to help somebody, and my life is worth helping one other person.
Oh, Stephanie, thank you for that. We also heard from Dick in Middleton, called in, couldn't stay with us, Dr. Safdar. And Dick wants to know, how much impact have the protests had on spreading the coronavirus?
It doesn't appear that the protests have led to a large spike in cases. It's sometimes not possible to tell entirely if that's the case or not, but it certainly doesn't seem to be.
In terms of businesses reopening, parties, gyms, churches, restaurants, bars, can we isolate anything there or extrapolate with the current surge?
I think that there are certain activities and certain places where it's very difficult to do the two measures that we know will work to interrupt transmission, physical distancing and masking. And a place, for example, is a restaurant or a bar. You're shoulder to shoulder, the music is loud, you can't hear each other, you're tempted to pull down your mask so that people can, so that you can talk easily, and you're eating and drinking so you can't effectively mask anyway. So that's sort of the perfect storm of why these areas might precipitate a cluster.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics, taking your questions about the virus, 800-642-1234. Dr. Safdar, as you've been watching the treatment protocols come out here on COVID-19, have any changes been made with how patients are being treated in the hospital right now?
Yes, so I think we have a couple of options now for treatment. One is convalescent plasma, which is plasma taken from people who have recovered from COVID-19. Another is a medication called remdesivir that is still in trials but has shown promise in reducing length of stay. And the third is steroids, which also appear promising. These are for hospitalized people with fairly severe illness. We're still seeking therapeutic options for those with mild symptoms that might benefit from something.
How early on do you give these type of treatments? Do you give this intervention?
You try to give them early on in the hospitalization because you want people to not get to the stage where they will require mechanical ventilation or need ICU care, if possible.
When you look at the tests coming back and the shape that the lungs are in, are you seeing any changes that way in how the virus is affecting the lungs?
I think that it takes a pretty profound toll on lung health. And the impact of that it has really depends upon how well your lungs were doing before you got sick with COVID-19. So in people who already have pre-existing lung disease or are smokers or have vaped or have otherwise, you know, had lung damage for any reason, they would have a much harder time recovering from it than others would.
Many schools are trying to figure out how to prepare to bring kids back in the fall. What do we know about COVID-19 in children?
Children, particularly younger children, tend to get mild symptoms and don't appear to be a population of high risk for COVID-19. They can, however, get post-infectious syndromes, which are not a direct effect of the virus, but nonetheless, the body's response is severe enough that they need hospitalization and might even need ICU care. Older children, high schoolers and above, will tend to behave very much like young adults in the way that they contract and spread the illness. So, and it's a setting where people are together in large numbers, so it's a high-risk situation.
We have time for one more call. Steve in Antioch. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I had a question. You were talking about the droplets falling, you know, within 6 feet of a person. Should we be disinfecting our shoes because we will be stepping on these droplets?
I think shoes in general are to be considered contaminated in all settings. Whether one disinfects or not, I don't think it's a bad idea necessarily to disinfect them. I can tell you from the healthcare worker viewpoint, we do encourage that people leave their shoes outside the house when they come back in after work, and that the pair of shoes that they use should be designated for work activity and not, you know, wearing it around the house.
Well, I can take one look at my kids' shoes and they're contaminated, that's for sure. That's all I know. Dr. Safdar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Just ahead, we talk to the author of a new book about Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, about the never-before-seen documents he used to write the biography. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.